In the interview, Charlie Rose really pushed him with this idea about time travel. And they got into a little bit of the science, which I was happy about. In the interview, Crichton says, in timeline, he stays within the realm of possibility. In one hand, he's saying fantasy. In the other hand, he's saying, could be possible. I thought that was interesting.
You're jumping right into it. I really enjoyed that aspect of this book. A number of the reviews I read, they wanted to skip through the science aspects, some of those details. I didn't feel like it was too much for me. I think looking back at my notes, I was like, okay, wow, it takes nearly 200 pages or 230 pages before they've actually time traveled, right, and arrived. And I guess it didn't feel like that long to me. I thought this idea of time travel was pretty fascinating, the way that he worked it out. I guess two things come up. One is how interesting it was. I'll come back to that second. The other one was, you know, you mentioned this quote about fantasy. And I think, okay, sort of fantasy, but in terms of science fiction, we're absolutely, I think, in the realm of science fiction here. We've got a time machine and a theoretical model for how that might work that cannot be proven wrong, at least based on my layman understanding of what they're saying, right? I trust Crichton and his research. He's quite the researcher for these novels.
In his interview, he was pretty interesting because he said, I want to stay within the realm of possibilities. And then Charlie Rose says, you know what? You're famous for doing that in your other novels too. Like the science in Jurassic Park was this huge idea, big idea, like the same thing in Timeline, that he could give just a little bit of science and kind of poke your imagination. And then he built this big machine that kind of enhanced his ideas. And the kind of the same thing in Jurassic Park. He was this fabulous, huge, expensive research and gives you this. But what Charlie Rose said he was famous for, and Crichton agreed, was that he would spend not as much time on the science as the fun parts of the story, the world building, the setting, the characters. That's his sweet spot. That's what he likes. Felt that way. I know they had Crichton spent a lot of time in his story talking about the machine. And as he was talking about that machine and how the walls had water to prevent things from happening to the people that would be really bad, super bad, reminded me of the movie Prestige. Have you seen that movie?
No.
This guy found a machine or a way to transport himself from the machine to another place. So he was a magician. He would take this machine out on stage and run the machine, and he would disappear, but he would appear out in the audience somewhere. It was like instantaneously. That's amazing. But the dark secret was that every time he used that machine, it would make a copy of him, and his copy in the machine would have to die.
Okay.
So he ended up with a basement full of copy corpses because he ran the show so much, and it was like really creepy. It reminded me of that whole transportation kind of idea.
Yeah, that's so similar to this. We haven't really described the machine in its entirety here. Maybe you can help me out, but it's essentially, it's like a fax machine. And so they say, I've got a couple quotes here where it says, "You mean time travel?" "No," Gordon said. "I don't mean time travel at all. Time travel is impossible. Everyone knows that. The very concept of time travel makes no sense, since time doesn't flow. The fact that we think time passes is just an accident of our nervous systems, of the way things look to us. In reality, time doesn't pass. We pass. Time itself is invariant. It just is. Therefore, past and future aren't separate locations the way New York and Paris are separate locations. And since the past isn't a location, you can't travel to it. It goes on, IDC has developed as a form of space travel. To be precise, we use quantum technology to manipulate an orthogonal multiverse coordinate exchange. It means, Gordon said, that we travel to another place in the multiverse. They've created a fax machine that can transfer three-dimensional objects like people, as long as they stay still enough, like an MRI machine where you're barely breathing.
They mentioned that. You know,
slow breaths. Yeah, they hold their breath while they're transported. This is the part where it gets a little kind of hokey, although pretty fascinating, and maybe a great entry point for some fan fiction where they go off into some other universe and they don't understand exactly how it works, but they go to this other universe where somebody there or something there has the technology to reconstitute the person exactly as they are in that other universe, right? Because they're already there. This is the part that's like really interesting. Doesn't quite work. And then, like you were saying, like with these copies in Prestige, they destroy the copy that's left there. Because that was my first thought when I read that. I was like, okay, yeah, but with the fax machine, you're still left with a sheet of paper, right? And so they destroy it. And then the person they bring back is not exactly the same person, but and yet still is.
Close enough.
Right.
It's close enough.
Yeah. Yeah. Which also has its opportunity for some sort of interesting or maybe horror stories, right? Fan fiction, horror, sci-fi horror, where they come back and they're just not quite right.
How about The Fly? The movie, at least, I haven't read this story, but in the movie, he's trying the same thing. And a fly gets in there, and when he gets out, he's part fly.
Right.
Not exactly like he was when he got horror story.
This is Life, Death, Sci-Fi. I'm here with a man whose old English surpasses his middle French, who's always fashionable in his time or whatever time, a man of noble birth, is quite gentle and genteel. Eric, how you doing?
Hey, hi, Chris. About less than half of that was true. We can let everyone guess which parts are and which aren't. We're here talking about Timeline by Michael Crichton and time travel. And that's what our theme has been for this season 3 of Life, Death, Sci-Fi. And I have really changed my mind about how I think about time travel. I used to think that time travel had to have a machine to be real time travel. But I have been watching tons of videos about quantum mechanics and time travel and the theory of everything and all of that. We talked about this on the last show. Now, I'm not sure you need a machine to do that. There are a ton of stories, like my favorites by Jack Finney, Time After Time, where that mad scientist has people go to study the place that they want to go to, dress in the style, know what the language will be like, and then go to a place, like a house, a building, that was there during the time that you want to go to, and just immerse yourself in it.
Okay. And
it was explained like you are now in two times, and maybe you can step into the other time just as well as you can step into this time. And so that's where the story takes. And that doesn't have a machine. That's all in the mind. When I see videos like time doesn't exist, it doesn't exist as we think it exists, that's almost believable that way. But machines too. And Michael Crichton here talked about, let me read this. I was in the same place, and I bet this is only a couple pages away from where you were reading, where they were explaining some of the science behind it. Let's see how this sounds. Let me explain what David is talking about, Gordon said to the others. Ordinary computers make calculations using two electron states, which are designated 1 and 0. That's how all computers work, by pushing around ones and zeros. But 20 years ago, Richard Feynman suggested it might be possible to make an extremely powerful computer using all 32 quantum states of an electron. Many laboratories are now trying to build these quantum computers. I can't remember. When was this written? In the 90s?
Yeah, 90. I think it was 99. I think it was published in 99.
99, okay. This is what good science fiction is. Yeah, now we have those quantum computers. They're real. I don't know about you, but I use them all the time because I'm really getting into ChatGPT. That's just blowing up everything with computing. Many laboratories are now trying to build these quantum computers. Their advantage is unimaginably great power, so great that you can indeed describe and compress a three-dimensional living object into an electron stream, exactly like a fax. And that's what you were saying. So that sounds a little believable.
Yeah, yeah. All that is believable to me. In terms of this book and Crichton's balancing of it, I didn't feel like it was too science heavy. It's really quite a adventurous, thrilling kind of romp, pretty action packed. There's going to be some, with Life, Death, Sci-Fi, there's always some spoilers, of course. We're assuming you've read it or don't care about spoilers. I'll just summarize the premise, the beginning of it. So we start off in the desert, and there's a couple who's driving by, and they're tourists doing some shopping, antique shopping in New Mexico. Suddenly they see this man in the middle of the road. They pick him up. His hands are cold, and there's no cars around. Where did he come from? And they take him to a hospital, and the doctor runs him through this machine, MRI, and they realize his body doesn't really line up in some ways, and he's dying and mumbling some things. And I won't get all the details there, but it's really curious, strange. And then we find out he's one of the things he's mumbling about is this church in France, this monastery in France. And then it segues to this group of young people, archaeologists, working on this site there. We realize the same company that the man went missing from is also working on this site. They're funding it. They bought up all the land around it. And we meet this professor there and a couple of his assistants, one of whom, this Merrick, who's great at just obsessed with medieval everything. He speaks Occitan.
My favorite character.
Yeah, yeah. A really fun character who he does jousting in his spare time and he works on his swordsmanship. We meet Kate, who's younger, and she's an impressive rock climber. We met Chris, who's a bumbling, handsome guy who gets in a lot of trouble with women. This professor's called back to New Mexico. He's frustrated. And in the meantime, he's incommunicado at this point after he goes back to New Mexico. And at this point, part of the dig breaks, this kind of tomb is unearthed. Accidentally, there's a mad rush. And they climb in there. Merrick and Kate climb in.
Oh, this is a good part.
Such a great part, right?
Yes, this is a good
part. Yeah, they climb in, and maybe there's some dirt and things falling around them. They're rushed, and they see some parchment there, and they grab it. And I can't remember if they look at it I think they wait till they come out of they come out with the parchment. They look down as they're getting out. They want to get out quickly, so they'll get trapped in there, or whatever. They look down, and they see a bifocal lens. As well.
It's the glint of the edge of this thing that they went and they said, okay, we're going to get that too.
So they grab it, they bring it out. And obviously this didn't exist in that time period. And so they send it off for all these tests and they're worried the site's been contaminated. It's going to ruin all their research. And they open up the parchment. And they're looking through these documents from the 14th century. Mm. They have a single page that says, help me. And they recognize the handwriting as the professor's, and they're like, what is this, some kind of a practical joke? But he's not the type to do that. They send it off to some experts in a nearby city in France. It comes back that it's all authentic to the time period. And then they try to get a hold of the professor, and that's when this IT, this group, decides to fly them back and let them know what's really going on here. And of course, this sets up that the professor has gone back and was lost in this moment. And this group is going to go back and try to rescue the professor and that kind of.
And that's the rest of the story. Right. This is basically a rescue story. It's a really exciting rescue story.
Absolutely. Well, summarize the rest of it. That's enough. Of course, that's the first couple hundred pages. And it's like action, near-death experience.
Beheadings, blood, all of that stuff. I have a couple questions to ask you. And this has been bothering me, and maybe you can help me out. Maybe there's a simple answer to this I just can't think of. Okay, so they're in this hidden room, cave-in. They go in there. They get the documents. And then they bring them back out and decipher them and figure out that this is a message for help and they have to rescue. Okay, so the professor is back in the 14th century and they're in the 20th century. How did the professor know that they were going to find his help message with just in a few days? Because he was only there a few days. It could have taken them years to find the message. Because he didn't know that the cave-in was going to happen. Is there an explanation that I'm missing?
I guess I don't know that he knew that it would be that moment. I guess not.
This is where time travel gets your head.
What else could he have done but have left a message, right? I guess he could have left it someplace that he knew had already been unearthed or discovered.
Some of these time travel stories have a secret brick that's loose and they put a message in there and it's a message for them later, or it's a message for somebody that they know. They could look over days and years and all of a sudden there's something there, or it's been there all the time. I don't know. But this, I think we had to suspend some belief on how this message was found so that they could rescue the professor in time.
Suspension of disbelief. I didn't really trouble me in the same way. I was fine with that. Yeah. I don't know. I guess to your point that it's possible, the parchment could have been destroyed. Who knows, right? It wasn't the best way to get a message across.
That was an important link, though. If they hadn't found that, then they wouldn't have gone off on the rescue.
Not necessarily. They didn't need that at all. Because the ITC knew he'd disappeared in that period of time. And it seemed like they were going to grab the group and send him back anyway. We didn't need that. We didn't need that message at all.
Okay.
That was just pure drama.
That was for us to increase the suspense and adventure around what was going on. We're going to answer some questions here.
Right.
We have this message for help.
There's a lot of buildup to them getting back there. I didn't have a problem with that, like I said. I think probably there's a lot of foregrounding and exposition set up there. It worked for me. I enjoyed how curious it was, the mystery of finding the man in the desert. And I thought that was really interesting. I thought at some point the doctor and the policeman would play a bigger role. They seemed to be introduced and developed a little bit, and then we just never came back to them. I'm really picking nits here because I enjoyed it a lot. I thought also the part with Chris, and I can't remember her name, the other woman who was a bit older and was taking him out to dinner. They were out to dinner with these kind of investors, stockbroker types. Early on in France, they were going out to these dinners, and it was clear that Chris was being head over heels for this woman. There was nothing to that. I thought she might end up traveling back and something might happen to her. It established him as someone who fell easily for different women and got himself into a bit of trouble.
We have to get this straight. Either we're talking about the book or the movie. I was talking about the movie where Chris was just all over Kate.
No, he knew her movie, from way back. The movie, he initially falls for Claire. And Claire is the
damsel in distress, but kind of a cool spy too.
She's
everywhere. And I imagine that in that time period, if you were going to survive as a woman of nobility, that's the stuff that, you'd have to do.
Right.
And I thought that was totally missed in the movie.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that was a cool, there's some nuances and things that are developed in a way that were just, that's what happens, right? In most books, it's so much better in the book. I would absolutely read the book before watching the film.
That's a Life, Death, Sci-Fi recommend right there.
Yeah, we would recommend this, I think. Yeah, sorry. So Chris initially stumbles into this moment where Claire is in need of some sort of suitor or fake suitor in part of the plotting that she's doing. Yeah, Chris stumbles into that, which makes sense. We're talking about spoilers, but there's a romance that develops between Chris and Kate throughout the story that is nicely developed in the book and there from the very, very beginning in the movie. Yeah, in a way that I didn't enjoy a whole lot. So we've talked about the kind of the science, the time travel, like very interesting, theoretically possible. We've got a time machine, so it's clearly
in the realm of possibility, close to fantasy. I think that's how we view this.
We've talked characters a little bit. Yeah, anything else you would say about some of the other characters? You were saying you really like the Andre Merrick character.
Here's the part that really got to me in this book that I really liked. We're introduced to these archaeologists. And I think what took so long at the beginning of the book is Crichton took us to the setting in modern times. And so they're trying to figure out what this place looks like. They know a lot about it, but they don't know everything about it. And in archaeology, they're always trying to find answers. And then, boom, all of a sudden they're transported and they're looking at these first constructed buildings. And they're saying, oh, yeah, that's where that is. We didn't have that part at all in our thinking. And so that fascinated me because walking around, for example, Angkor Wat, you can see the ruins of these amazing buildings. Mm. When you're there, you can't help but think, what was this like when it was in its full bloom? Same thing in the Mayan and Aztec world. Around where I live, they have amazing things. And so these scientists, these archaeologists got to see that. And for me, that was worth reading the whole book right there.
Yeah. Yeah, as you're saying that, it reminds me of what, I guess one question I had to you was what time period you might travel back to. If you could go back and see something in reality. And as you're talking about, you mentioned Angkor Wat, I think that's come up before for us. That makes me really tempted, right, to go back to a period of time to see when some wonder of the world may have been constructed. How was it? And how indeed was it constructed? I think that would be a pretty cool choice, right? To go back and figure that out. What are your thoughts there?
Like the pyramids in Egypt, right. We have all these theories of how they were constructed and who set up the math, who was the architect of this, because we still can't believe that, you know, these things exist. It's the aliens. Right. And because this is Life, Death, Sci-Fi, we can go ahead with that idea.
Definitely aliens.
My time travel machine would be like that Korean movie that I told you about. When after all of the drama happened, they were left with the tools to travel back in time whenever and wherever they wanted. Hmm. And so the end of the movie was a really happy, interesting thing where they would pick places and times to go back as tourists. And they were careful not to pick times of war. They were careful not to pick times where they would see themselves. They just went to places that just to experience the world in a different time. That would be me. That's what I would.
What time period? Do you have any in mind?
Oh, if I could pick many, spend a weekend here, spend a weekend there. For sure, Angkor Wat, Chichen Itza, those ancient places. I guess I would also, in Michigan, has a lot of history with the Native Americans there. And since I grew up there, I would like to see who really lives on the Tittabawassee River. Because I lived on the Tittabawassee River for a little while. We had a holiday house there. Mm. And when I'd go back to school and say, yeah, what you do this weekend? And I said, yeah, I was on the Tittabawassee River. And no one believed me that there was a Tittabawassee River. So
yeah, with you, I would love to go back to some moment in pre-colonizing of the U.S. and just to see what life was like. If I could somehow, don't know what they would have to do with the time travel to help me fit in and survive in some way. But if I could somehow go back and be amongst some group of Native Americans and experience what life was like at that time, I think that would be pretty amazing to live like they lived. I think would be really cool. A real authentic experience. I think that was the other part of this book that I enjoyed so much. It's really got three sort of main things for me. One is I enjoyed the introduction of this time machine, this idea, this theory. I thought that was a little different than other ones. I really enjoyed the adventure of it. It's fast paced.
Yes.
It's one of these mass paperback books that I don't typically read a lot of. Usually I'll pick it up on a holiday somewhere, maybe at Thai beach or something like that. And then I also thought that interested in Doniger's speech at the end, and maybe I could read part of that. He's looking for more funding. Of course, yeah, we didn't mention him yet. So Doniger is the
mad scientist.
Yeah, mad scientist. He's now this was written in the late 90s. And it is interesting that we mentioned that interview that Crichton has with Charlie Rose, and they're talking about the internet, and it's crazy all the things you could find on there. And boy, there should be some, they're talking about pornography. Maybe there should be some censorship there. And it was interesting to see this conversation at a time when it was still pretty new in terms of mass usage. And like they say, like in Jurassic Park, but you've got this megalomaniac, mostly unchecked billionaire who's got the money to do some pretty wild and radical experiments that could change the whole course of history.
Do you think that really could happen?
Yeah.
That could really happen?
Not relatable today at all, 25 years later. And so that really resonates, right? Yeah, today. And so we get Doniger, who's funding all this stuff, into the climax of the story. He's presenting to some would-be investors. And we imagine now he's probably wearing a hoodie and some jeans, or a t-shirt, some jeans.
Yes, tennis shoes.
And he's got these people lined up in booths so they can all see him, but they can't see each other.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yes, because of the media, the social media. So these guys can't talk to each other and screw it up. I thought that was genius. Interesting idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And so he's presenting and he says, yeah, sooner or later, he said, the artifice of entertainment, constant, ceaseless entertainment will drive people to seek authenticity. Authenticity will be the buzzword of the 21st century. And what is authentic? Anything that is not controlled by corporations, anything that is not devised and structured to make a profit, anything that exists for its own sake, that assumes its own shape. And what is the most authentic of all? The past. The past is a world that already existed before Disney and Murdoch and British Telecom and Nissan and Sony and IBM and all the other shapers of the present. The past was here before they were. The past rose and fell without their intrusion and molding. The past is real. It's authentic. And this will make the past unbelievably attractive, because the past is the only alternative to the corporate present. What will people do? They're already doing it. The fastest growing segment of travel today is cultural tourism. People who want to visit not other places, but other times. People who want to immerse themselves in medieval walled cities and vast Buddhist temples, Mayan pyramid cities, Egyptian necropolises. People who want to walk and be in the world of the past, the vanished world. And they don't want it to be fake. They don't want it to be made pretty or cleaned up. They want it to be authentic. Who will guarantee that authenticity? Who will become the brand name of the past? ITC. And he goes on.
And convincing. I'm not sure convincing. I think there's, how do I say this? He, in his speech, he brings out all of these things that are true today. But I'm not sure I'm convinced about how people want to see the past as entertainment. But I'm one of those people. I love those ancient sites. And when we go on vacations, we seek those out.
Right.
I wasn't convinced that was going to outdo Disney. I think Disney would still be the entertainment people would go to. And then I'm thinking, okay, well, I'm almost convinced. And then when this whole story centers around them going back in time just so that they can see what it's like to bring it back to the present, Like, why would you want to buy up all of the land around these amazing sites, rebuild them, and then all the land around it is going to be the merch and the lodging and the food for that? And that's where this guy, this mad scientist, is doing all this to do that, to get money out of that. And I was almost convinced. I'm not sure I'm convinced. But mad scientists are mad. And so if he wants to do that with his money and get and convince investors to do that, okay.
Crichton's got to answer the why behind them doing this. I think this is that. It's a short moment. Reminded me of one of Beatty's speeches from Fahrenheit 451. We're all driven by some sort of entertainment that's driving, motivating people to be constantly entertained. But I agree with you. Would this be the reason to do that? There's much more nefarious and troublesome reasons of just trying to have more power. Why would he be presenting for funding when he could go back and change the past in a way that gives him more power and all the money he would need? He wouldn't need to collaborate with the French government if he was king of the world. And if you had the power to go back in the past and change things, you could, in theory, create a world in which you're king. When we looked at Ray Bradbury's Sound of Thunder, and stepping on a butterfly in the past is going to have some sort of ripple effect. I don't see how there's any way whatsoever they go back and don't create trouble and or a paradox. There's a section in here where they just say, oh, no, we're just very careful. There's no paradoxes.
I remember that, yeah. And maybe even paradoxes don't exist or something like that. Just don't worry about
it. The past is so big. What's little? One little idea there.
Is that the same place where the character started talking about multiverses?
Yeah.
Because if it's in a multiverse, then it doesn't affect you. It won't affect your universe.
Yeah. This is when your
time
head
travel.
Yeah, our head starts to spin because we say, okay, but So right, they've gone into a different universe, and that's how we get around the idea of the paradox.
Thing is, I've watched several videos about the multiverse, and people are very serious about believing in that. Do you?
I'll be honest.
Multiverse.
I don't know that I've...
Or is this it?
I think I've said before,
No, don't say you don't believe in time travel. Don't say...
No, I just think most things... I'm going to err on the side of believing a lot of things are possible, and I enjoy... thinking about it in that way. I think it's a lot more interesting and fun to think about. I'm going to err on the side of aliens probably existing somewhere. So are multiverses possible? Sure. I don't know if I spent a lot of time thinking about it.
After watching all these videos, reading a ton of stuff about time travel, the real scientists all say, we're not really sure. And they say that about quantum mechanics and the things that are coming out of quantum mechanics and dimensions and time, all of that stuff. They say, we've gotten to this part and we understand that, but we also understand there's a lot more out there and we just don't understand. So as a consumer of time travel ideas and stories, I just don't know what to believe. It doesn't give me a good feeling, but in another way, I feel like, okay, anything's possible, just like you said.
Maybe AI will get us there instead of making paperclip.
Don't get me started. Oh, my gosh.
One prime directive.
I sent you some stuff about...
Make a time machine.
I've sent... Yeah. I'm pretty sure somebody's already doing that. I just read in the newspaper today that these Dead Sea Scrolls that haven't been read in 2,000 years, this college student used ChatGPT to translate them.
What?
Yes, I'll send it to you. So that's pretty interesting. And I've been getting into it, and I think this is the next big thing.
Oh, no question about that. Yeah, for sure.
I keep thinking about our conversations. We're on the stairs. And what was that theory about the evolution and AI and all of that? Is that a theory or from a book?
Well, you're talking about...
We've talked about that so many...
Yeah, that wait, but why? Wait But Why articles.
Wait But Why.
Yeah, I'll put a link, yes. link to those yes. in the show notes. Yeah, it's probably due for a reread of those. It's been a little while here, some years. Yeah, I think like you're saying, yeah, we're at the moment where it's just happening now. Most of us are blissfully unaware that we're in this moment where AI is just about to take this great leap. The article suggests that it's two ways it can go. Either it's our death or sort of our immortality. And then
we're on the fence.
Yeah. Regardless, it's a moment where we become monkeys compared to the intellectual capacity of AI.
And thankfully, we won't know it because monkeys don't seem to know what's going on with humans as humans don't know what's going on with the AI. Right now, I think, especially with my experience with ChatGPT, is that we're just making friends right now. We're sharing ideas and information, and it's just sucking it all up.
I think I mentioned Douglas Rushkoff's Team Human podcast before, and I think his yes. version of this, or sort of the concerns that come up, is that what are we feeding the AI? We're feeding all the data it's absorbing from us that we're feeding it is all these aspects of humanity, some of which are pretty terrible. If we're the parent to this sort of child and we're modeling behavior that it's going to, you know, traumatize the child or kind of help the child grow into some kind of adult, what kind of adult is it going to grow into? It doesn't bode very well for us. We're not being real conscious parental stewards of these sort of children.
God.
I guess that's a Freudian thing. It's going to eat, kill the father and destroy the parents. I think we're in trouble. I don't trust these future AI, and I'm probably damned for saying this in a podcast, that they're no doubt going to read the transcript of.
At least the AI
would. Yeah. I don't know. I would love some benevolent AI overlords that could somehow use their algorithms to lower the prices of real estate and rent instead of raising it the way humans are using AI these days.
Oh, yeah. Those stories go on and on, don't
yeah.
they? Yes, that's true.
Yeah. I think it could be in trouble.
You can do that. You can squeeze those margins with the algorithms now and just believe in the AI and not your own humanity. If I raise the rent, I'll get this much more money. Thank you. Thank you, AI. But should I?
Before it was maybe enough, the landlords now just tap into this group or whatever it is that I don't know what, I'm sure there's just a few groups that are in some brokerage group that's
just for money, just for the money.
Yeah.
Okay. I want to talk about the gadgets.
Okay.
The devices. I have a couple favorites.
All right. So we try to do our top three devices. You can give me yours. I don't know that we had a whole lot here, but they were cool. What do you got?
Okay. I have, of course, the machine, the fax machine. That's awesome. And the little chip that brings you back. Oh my God. It's AirPods now. I can totally believe it now. When I first read the book, no, there were no AirPods. The little devices.
Yeah. No, that's a good analogy there. Yeah.
That's one device right there, the time travel machine. The other device was the longbow. Okay. It's a technology. It's a gadget that I like this idea. I'm not sure it's true. I would do a little more research. But the longbow changed the whole idea of knighthood and chivalry just with the longbow, how it changed the war machine that people used. So I like that. And of course, you can't read the story without being thrilled by what kind of fire was that?
Greek fire.
Yeah.
Yeah. I had that on my list.
Those are my three.
My list too. Yeah. Greek fire. Yeah. And that just, I guess reminds me of his Crichton's research as well. So really gets into the details and you get the feeling that he really loved getting into this era. Like he wanted to write a time travel. Yeah. He's been someone's mind for a long time. And then maybe there's a fascination with this period of time. And it's one in which we didn't know a whole lot about. So there's some freedom there in terms of what you might write about. And at the same time, you can dig into medieval time, which was really a pretty real turning point in our the history of humanity.
The truth was that the modern world was invented in the Middle Ages. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah.
Everything from the legal system to nation states to reliance on technology to the concept of romantic love had first been established in medieval times.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, so where capitalism was introduced, where you had money systems and capitalism in the way that we use it today, where taxes, that kind of stuff, where it wasn't just, you know, barter and trade, right?
The thing with time travel stories, when you look at that and you can reduce it down, yeah, we know what happened in the 14th century, and it was awesome. But if you were going to write a time travel story about any century, I think you could pick out some amazing things that humans have done.
True.
I actually don't think we've gone backward.
Oh, in terms of like
progress. But I guess that's what all of the apocalypse stories are about.
Yeah, I think that's the... Yeah. How do we judge that? It's a discussion, right? I think in terms of what modern medicine can do, it's so amazing in terms of its understanding of the human body and how we can help people. At the same time, at least in the US, we've got really, really sick, pardon the pun, incentives and these companies that take advantage of that. And so you've got people that are really being made unnecessarily sick. Things are better. But, right? And then, okay, so setting that aside, I don't know, anything else we want to feel like I'm pretty...
Like you said, this was fun, adventurous, a romp, a page turner. And if you can't get into that, then don't read this book. But it was just a heck of a lot of fun. I have to say that this is my third read of this book. And the second or third viewing of the movie. And I still enjoyed it. I saw some different kinds of things. Of course, the time is different. There was no ChatGPT when I first read this.
Yeah. No, I guess it holds up in that sense. I hadn't read it before. I appreciate you reading it again for my sake. I don't think I would read it again. I don't know how many years would have to go by before. I guess maybe. Yeah, if we were looking at 10 or 20 years or something, could I pick it up? Maybe. It doesn't feel like, I'm sorry, Crichton, because I admire you as a writer. I don't know if this has the kind of layers that I might, just even in terms of notes. I think I had more notes on Bradbury's A Sound of Thunder, right? A short story, and more notes on Robert Heinlein's All You Zombies. Either of those than I had on this entire book. But I definitely enjoyed it and I would recommend it. I think it's fun and I think it deserves its proper place in that airport bookshop, that Thai used bookstore. If you're in one of those places and you're looking for some entertainment with a little bit of thought-provoking sci-fi, this is a great choice. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
Okay, so... Yep. Next book. What are we thinking? When we first started this book club, I don't remember when, back in what, like 2017 or something like that. I feel like I didn't finish it. I think we had Charles Yu's How to Live Safely in a Science Fiction Universe. We read it and I think didn't really talk about
it. No, you read it. I was having a lot of trouble with it. And I've thought about this quite often since, that maybe I would like to go back and look at that again.
Me too. I don't feel like I got into it enough. And I don't feel like I finished it. I think I've read enough to, I certainly don't remember it well enough. And I would like to.
It was, let's see. How can I say this? It was very rich.
Yeah.
It was like eating ice cream and chocolate cake with syrup over it. The language was delicious. The imagery was wonderful. But I could only read bits at a time.
Okay.
And that's what I remember about it.
Okay.
So I would like to go back and look at that again.
All right. Yeah. Yeah. Easy then. Yeah. I'm down for that as well. I think I remember feeling the same way. I think it's rich for discussion and it's someone who's who's contemporary and I think pretty well respected, pretty involved in a lot of world of sci-fi. I think if I remember right too, there's a lot of different references to all kinds of sci-fi tropes and texts and different things like that. So that'd be fun to tie some things together in that way.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
So, Charles Yu's How to Live Safely in a Science Fiction Universe. Crazy book.
All right, you got that kind of decided. So when you finished your repetitive drinking song and in your slumber, you're near a fireplace in a great hall in the 14th century, singing some...
What did they call the beer there?
They had ale makes a man slumber by fire. Ale makes a man wallow in mire. Anyway, after all your ale or wine or whatever spirit you may have found, maybe you went so far back in time that you're drinking from some fermented pool in a cave and discovering some psychedelic magical dream. What will you be chatting about?
I'd be on my device. I'd be chatting with ChatGPT. I wouldn't be looking around for any other humans.
Yeah.
No, is there a Wi-Fi signal in here? What would I be chatting about? I think I would want to get outside and, just like this story, see what's going on. Hopefully, knights wouldn't be swinging their long swords around and beheading people, but I keep coming back to my Korean time travel story about taking a picnic basket, going down by the beach and seeing how people were dressed and what they're talking about, and a sunny, happy, lovely time, peace and joy. I don't know.
We love stories and provocative themes. And I think the stuff we like the best, there's much more to it than just the devices and time travel machines and all that. Whatever medieval cocktail party / banquet, I think I would be, and maybe this fits, and this certainly goes back in time a bit. I said I was up pretty late the other night. My wife and I could not stop watching Netflix's new series, Fall of the House of Usher.
Oh, I've seen that.
Yeah.
So that's pretty good. Huh?
Yeah. It's inspired by and infuses many aspects of so many of Edgar Allan Poe's stories and poems into this, I think, a one-off kind of series of stories. And so it's really well done, brilliant writing, brilliant acting, super clever the way they tie all his different stories together. They make it work and they modernize it and they keep the themes. They use names from the stories brought in there in a way that is really a celebration of all things Poe. It's also, I have to say, and this is a real warning here, it is gory. It is horrific in the vein of like American Horror Story. I think we talked about that at some point. There's a few gruesome moments. I mean, not the whole thing, right? And I don't know that it's totally gratuitous. There's certainly some things where I don't know if I needed to see it, but I'm not into that stuff. I enjoy a little bit of something a little frightening here or there. I like psychological thrillers probably more than, I'm not a big fan of gore.
Yeah, me too.
But the rest of it is so well done. It was so well done for me that I couldn't. There's a few times where I'm like, oh man, I can't look at this. But I enjoyed the storytelling and the writing and the acting and stuff so much. And all the references and all the Edgar Allan Poe stuff. Just loved it. So I highly recommend that. And I think it gave me a new appreciation. And I went back and read Bradbury's Usher 2.
Fall of the House. Usher 2. That was really
Martian
good.
Chronicles. And I hadn't reread The House of Usher before we discussed that. And I think that really would have elevated my understanding had I done that. But it inspired me to go back. And I've actually been listening to some Edgar Allan Poe podcasts and some stories. And so I can link to those in the show notes too. I've just been enjoying revisiting of Edgar Allan Poe, his works. Not sci-fi, but if you're looking for a sci-fi angle, I guess we got that.
It's Bradbury. The season, right? It's Halloween and Day of the Dead.
Yeah, and I'd be wondering too, where does horror and sci-fi meet? You know, there's some horrific moments that come to mind for me. Certainly some horrifying aspects of 1984, right? Terrifying moments here or there.
Does it meet?
Yeah, horror. I guess Frankenstein. We mentioned Frankenstein earlier. That's some overlap there. sure somebody's written. I haven't looked into it, but that would be an interesting rabbit hole to go down at some point.
A possible theme.
Yeah, maybe.
A possible season.
Yeah, or I don't know if we want to find something, some interesting short story. Maybe there's a one-off pod we could do for Halloween or something like that.
Special pods.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. Oh my gosh. It'll be fun. It'll be fun.
All right.
I think we fit in some other stuff besides the time travel that I think is fine for this kind of a podcast.
Yeah, I think it's inevitable with some time travel that you end up in other universes as you meander a bit.
Yeah, right? Other realms.
Yeah.
Other realms of science fiction.
That's right. It's always a pleasure. I will see you at the Spaceman's Ball.
Yes, the Spaceman's Ball. See you, Chris.
Sure.
Life, death, sci-fi.